From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection for this hour was made when a 7-year-old girl walked up to her mother at the kitchen sink and said, matter-of-factly, quote, "You're lucky you got to have your adulthood before the planet was completely destroyed by climate change," end quote. You might have heard the story on NPR. The mother was surprised. She told NPR she didn't realize the issue was on her daughter's mind at 7. She hadn't spent that much time talking to her about it, and she says she was concerned that her daughter discussed the issue in a way she felt was sort of void of emotion. It was just a fact that she'd grown up in a world without a, she's going to grow up in this world without a functioning ecosystem, and it's all going to go wrong. Well, every child is different, of course, but research shows clinical anxiety is growing among children and teens in general. One source of that anxiety can be the environment and climate change. While some kids feel empowered by how they can help mitigate the crisis, others might feel overwhelmed or frightened at times. An NPR poll found that 84% of parents, and that includes strong majorities of both Democrats and Republicans, agree that children should be learning about climate change even at young ages. But only 45% of parents say that they have talked to their own kids about it. So how can parents have effective, productive, healthy, and emotionally literate conversations about climate change and their kids' future? We'll explore that question this hour with our guests. And listeners, if you want to join us and share your thoughts about how you talk to kids about climate, you can do that as well. And hello to our panel of guests. Dr. Michael Scharf is here. He is Chief of Child and Adolescent Psychiatry at the University of Rochester Medical Center. Welcome back to the program. Thanks for being here.
Thank you. Good afternoon.
Hello to Dr. Sandra Gee, who is an Associate Professor of Pediatrics and General Pediatrician at the University of Rochester Medical Center. Dr. Gee, welcome. Thanks for being here.
Thank you.
Dr. Annalyn Gibson is here. Annalyn is a Child and Adolescent Psychiatry Fellow at URMC. Welcome. Thanks for being here.
Thank you.
And hello to Sue Hugh Smith, who is a mom and also the co-founder of the Rochester People's Climate Coalition and has worked a long time in education herself. She knows a thing or two about trying to talk to people effectively about this, but kids is going to be the focus. Welcome. Thanks for being here.
Thanks for having me, Evan.
And we've met your son many times. And
yes.
So you've got a history in your own household of talking to children about climate change. But when you see and hear some of these stories, I am curious to start with you. Did that NPR story surprise you that a 7-year-old might walk up to a parent and say, hey, aren't you glad you had a life to live? Our future is sort of doomed here.
For 7, it's really surprising.
It's heavy
for
a 7.
7-year-old, yeah.
I mean, 7 years old, you want to teach them about these things, but does that say to you something's gone wrong, or does that say, look, I mean, kids are picking up on things?
I mean, it says to me that kids are receiving information that they aren't able to process in a adult way because they're kids, so they're receiving information and they're not getting support in understanding and interpreting the information that's coming at them.
Dr. Scharf, when you hear that story at 7, what comes to mind first for you?
Well, I'm curious how the 7-year-old first heard about it and how it was presented. And, you know, I have a feeling this will come up recurrently, but I think sometimes the words we use are careful because it reflects our attention. And in your intro, Evan, you mentioned that climate change or environmental concerns can be a source of anxiety. And I think I prefer using the term focus of anxiety, because one of the lessons we learn as we get to know kids and explore the things they're concerned about is that, first of all, kids are different. Some are going to be more anxious and some less anxious. You also mentioned anxiety phenomena and anxiety disorders are increasing anyway. And so it's not surprising that whatever is the topic of the day would be the thing that people who would be anxious anyway would be talking about. So I think there's both the specific fears that can be generated based on how the issues are presented and talked about with kids. And then it's also true that kids who are going to be anxious will glom on to things that are presented in a frightening way.
Well, I want to make sure I understand the distinction, first of all, between people who might have a predisposition to anxiety versus people who sort of come to feel anxious because of what they have learned or are thinking about. So first of all, do we know roughly in the general population how many people are sort of have a predisposition to anxiety or anxiety disorder?
So to the experience of anxiety, that's a universal feeling and condition. So being able to experience anxiety, even being intermittently really bothered by it, is a normal human feeling and reaction. Anxiety disorder is about 8%.
About 8%?
Yes.
Is that increasing?
It isn't. That's that's the current number, and it's higher than what I learned even in training because it has been increasing.
Okay. And do we generally, are we able to sort of sketch out a root cause or series of factors that have caused that increase to 8%?
So there's certainly things we've identified that are correlated with it. And the difference between correlation and causation is, of course, a big and important distinction. People's level of social engagement interaction has decreased, children's, as they've spent more time with screens and in more isolative and isolating patterns of activity. That certainly has correlated with increase in anxiety. The content of what people are seeing on the same screens, which could include catastrophic presentations or fears about climate change or the world ending, but could also include school shootings and other significantly upsetting things that happen in the world, in the news. And then people's interactions, cruelty between kids, that can happen and have a deleterious effect and can increase anxiety.
And forgive me if I'm not a very good student on making sure I understand this, but
sure.
when we think about something like alcoholism, my best understanding of alcoholism is that it is, please correct me if I'm misspeaking here, essentially inherent or in someone's DNA to be prone to addiction to alcohol, whereas other people in the population can have one drink, they can have four drinks, they don't have to drink for a week, they don't feel a need or an addiction. So it's sort of a you are fortunate or unfortunate situation, almost by a lottery of birth with alcoholism. Whereas I'm wondering, in anxiety, are some people sort of predisposed genetically? I mean, is this, you're going to have anxiety based on certain factors at birth?
Yeah, I think it is a good parallel.
Okay.
And for both anxiety and for alcoholism, it's slightly more complicated in that what you're predisposed to is the risk. And you're predisposed to being more likely, with alcohol, more likely to be addicted to that drug. And that predisposition is both about sort of the addiction components as we understand addiction and becoming dependent on things, but also that drug in particular providing a sense of relief the first time you ever experience it, and how rewarding that is and how much a relief it is to the other things going on in your life. So for anxiety, there are certainly people that are born predisposed to be more sensitive to things that are frightening or scary. And then there are things that can reinforce feeling anxious and letting people know you're anxious. So if you experience anxiety and you tell someone and they protect you and make you feel better immediately in a ironic way over time, people will experience more anxiety because experiencing the distress and acknowledging or announcing it gets reinforced. So you can be definitely predisposed to experiencing more anxiety, but what happens through your life can reinforce or make it worse. And then having had really adverse or horrible things happen, traumatic things happen, can also reinforce things that would be scary or frightening or promote anxiety, and sometimes to a distorted degree because of the experience you had previously, something that reminds you, even if it's unconsciously, but stimulates you or reminds you of the situation before the horrible thing happened, can elicit a real anxiety fear response.
All right, so let me ask all of our guests, and I'll follow up with Dr. Scharf first on this then. As we think about our kids, and we think about everyone, every age of child, kids are smart. I mean, they pick up on the conversations the adults around them are having. They're really tuned into the world, and frankly, they have access to information because of the screens in pretty immediate ways, even if sometimes we think, I mean, I'm saying that to my seven-year-old all the time. How did you know this? And it's actually distressing for me that I often now don't know where, even if it's like a good thing, we're doing a crossword, and I'll go, you know this word? I don't know how. And he doesn't know where he learned it. I mean, it's I can't control all the information now. It's coming at him on screens and in school and with friends and sometimes once in a while from me or his mother. So it's hard enough understanding exactly what your kids are being taught or how they're being taught. What's the role of a parent in trying to take something like climate change and address it or get out in front of it in ways that will say, we've got a crisis, it's real, we're going to do this in an appropriate way for the age? How do you do that?
Well, so first I want to start by saying if parents are becoming anxious about needing to prevent this anxiety in their children, to let everyone relieve themselves of any guilt about that, there's no way a parent could know everything the child's exposed to. You can know as much as you can, and you can try to put limits and teach good behaviors about limiting the quantity of time on screens, watching news, being exposed to things. But as a parent, you can't control everything. You can be open to talking about it. You can strategically bring up issues with climate, and it's not specific to climate, it can be anything, to check in about what your child is thinking about. And if, like the situation you described with the seven-year-old, they bring it up, really listen, ask them what they're thinking. Don't make assumptions. Really make sure you understand what their concern is and what their upset feelings are about. And then, to the extent you can, acknowledge uncertainty, but don't dwell on any component of the uncertainty. Like, don't dwell on the idea that this bad thing is going to happen, because you don't know. And limiting the amount of time you spend worrying about things that are uncertain, and then focusing behavior on something you can control. So with the seven-year-old who gives an example, I mean, with the example of a seven-year-old who talks about not having the environment, it might not be the first thing I said, but I wouldn't want to end the encounter without saying, hey, you know what? There's a park right now we can go to and experience the environment today, right now. Mm-hmm. You know, try to focus on doing something.
Yeah, I see Dr. Gibson nodding. And I want to kind of draw a parallel to the way kids will differ in how they get information that can be difficult. So in the last few days, a lot of people have been like talking to their kids about the helicopter crash that killed Kobe Bryant. So my son's seven, he's into sports. I mean, he's aware that it happened. And my own choice was not to kind of try to hide the news from him. I didn't want to dwell on it for hours. But it's real. I talked to him about it. And when I thought about a child being on that helicopter, I got emotional talking to him. And I told him, I said, I don't want to hide the fact that this is hard, that grief's real. But I also was kind of trying to key in on how he was reacting. Now, meanwhile, I've heard of other parents, and he was pretty, I don't know, it was pretty even keel about it. Whereas I've heard other parents say, you know, boy, kids were really hit by this. And some kids saying, well, I don't want to fly. You know, so if the parallel there is climate change, and some kids are going, wow, that sounds bad, and other kids are going, we have no future. I mean, every child reacts differently. How do you gauge what's the best way to kind of address it?
That's a great question, and I also love the parallel that you drew into this with talking about grief in other ways, because we run into this too, even when talking about family members and illness and scary diagnoses, things like that. As far as what specifically to be looking out for in each child, we talked a little bit about the genetic predisposition for anxiety and the different things that can be underlying and building on that. We think about our kids' temperament is the big thing that we look at with when they were born. Overall, you can kind of know, was your child easy to soothe as a baby or difficult? So that's something that you can take into account when you talk to them about anything difficult. But then also looking at the stage of development that they're in. And there's a bunch of different psychological models as to what the different stages of childhood development are. One that's coming to mind for elementary school kids versus middle school kids is in elementary school, they're very focused on their just starting school. They want to produce kind of the appropriate amount of work. They're focused on how they're comparing with their peers in that sense as far as production and industry. And then in middle school, high school ages, they're more focused on what's their role in all of this. So we might be seeing with our teenagers, they might be more focused on, well, what part can I play in this and what can I do to respond to this? I think that taking all of those into account when talking to your child would be important, but also to ask a lot of questions about where they're at and what have they heard and where's their understanding currently. So for a seven-year-old, kind of saying, well, I'm hearing what you're saying. I'm wondering where you got that information from and what other questions you may have, and starting overall pretty vague with everything. Just like you would talk about with a sick relative or even financial stress, a whole bunch of parents run into financial stress and wonder about how to talk about it with the kids. You want to let the kid know to be careful about purchases and things like that, but not alarm them into thinking, well, we're going to lose our home next month. So keeping all of those things in mind.
And that's interesting, thinking about asking, where did you get the information? Sometimes maybe they won't know, but sometimes you can get a helpful dose of, well, this came from class or this came from a friend. And that, you know, might that inform how you respond next?
Yeah, because then you're kind of thinking, what developmental level was the person who was giving you this information from? Where are they at? And how comprehensive is their understanding? If it's from a teacher in class, then you can kind of have a better understanding of how reliable that information is and how detailed it is versus a friend who's sharing something alarmist that they had heard from another friend and the rumor mill's spreading. Then you can kind of step in and know, okay, well, maybe I need to do a little more teaching on this.
Well, Dr. G, John writes to the program and says, I think it's child abuse to tell kids about climate change, particularly at a young age, and I think we are the ones creating the anxiety. We are creating anxiety disorders. I don't know if John is a doctor, but that's what John thinks. Mm-hmm. Is it child abuse to tell kids about climate change?
That sounds a little extreme to call it child abuse, but I think what Annalyn said is very important. It's really critical to think about a child's developmental age and understanding of whatever it is, if it's climate change, and what's appropriate. A 7-year-old is very young. I think maybe a 9 or 10-year-old close to fourth grade would be a good time to kind of tackle some of these bigger life issues and really listen and say, what do you think about that? I think really getting the child's perspective on what they're thinking about. I think Dr. Scharf had talked about like thinking about the parents managing their own anxiety. So much of the child's anxiety, I see this all the time in the office. The child's anxiety often comes from the parent's anxiety, and it just gets heightened when there are concerns in the office and at home. So I think it's really important for parents to kind of regulate themselves, listen, and kind of assess, what is the child asking me and how can I be leading them?
This is not meant to be a leading question, but do you generally assume that if you are working with a child who has a lot of anxiety, that there will be a parent with a lot of anxiety or sort of?
No.
Not necessarily.
But I think being sensitive to what is the social milieu in the family so that this, you know, is this may be, you know, nature versus nurture. And how can we help support this family move forward with this? I mean, we see this, I don't want to derail the conversation. I see this all the time with ADHD. We manage ADHD, and most of the time the parents have ADHD also. So it's very difficult to get through those visits because the parents are very distracted, often unmedicated, and they themselves are really hard to kind of focus. And I think that happens with anxiety too. Parents are very anxious. So we as healthcare providers have a role to kind of be a calming influence, we hope, most of the time.
Well, back to the conversation about that 7-year-old. Here's an email from a listener named Megan who says, I'm listening to the show right now about the 7-year-old that was concerned about climate change. I'm not sure why there's so much conversation about anxiety. It doesn't sound to me like the 7-year-old was experiencing anxiety. It sounds to me like she's been educated about climate change. I have a 4-year-old and a 6-year-old, and both of them know about climate change and know about how pollution can affect our water, animals, and climate. I think it would be more beneficial if the conversation was less about dealing with anxiety of kids and more about how we can be talking to our kids about climate change without scaring them. They should know what's going on. That's from Megan. Megan, I think we all agree. I mean, I think that's really what this is about. I think it's about understanding what is anxiety, how to recognize it, and what's appropriate at different ages. But I think that's a very different email, Sue Hugh Smith, than John saying teaching kids about climate change is child abuse.
I agree. Those are two very different emails. Absolutely. You got it.
Do you want to weigh in, pick a side there? I mean, I doubt you think teaching kids about climate change is inherently child abuse.
Oh, definitely not. I mean, I from my own parenting experience, I would say that I would kind of echo what all these professionals have said, which is you need to follow where your child is, right? So I never went out of my way to teach my kids about climate change. But they were well aware of the fact that when fracking was a, you know, potential for New York State, that I was leaving the house to, oh, where are you going? We're in this rally or this meeting, or I need to speak to this, you know, Public Service Commission. And they knew what I was doing, and they knew I was concerned about climate change. When my eldest was in fourth grade, he had a teacher in a class presented that climate change was controversial, and that bothered him. You see, and he took the initiative to do the research on the science and present it to this teacher that this is a scientific fact. He led that. I didn't try to hide any of the data. He could go as deeply as he wanted to on that issue. But philosophically, I tend to feel kids will do what is within their range to handle. And then he did that again in eighth grade. And so I only was ever a support to my kids in being a resource for them, guiding them to some particular, you know, academic or other sources for them to help them access information. I was willing to talk to them about it. You know, so I was present for them, but I really let them guide and decide how deeply they wanted to go into it.
But if Liam had been seven, and said what this child said, I actually take Megan's email, and I think it's making an important point, because what the mom told NPR was, my seven-year-old was sort of devoid of emotion and said it like it's just a fact, like she doesn't really have a future because of what we've done. My concern, and I'll ask the experts in a moment, my concern as a parent would be, even if the child is saying that factually at seven, that's a heavy fact. And I'd be worried that if that sort of permeates the seven-year-old's brain, eventually that could lead to anxiety. But
look,
I don't know if that means...
I'm not a doctor, Evan. but this
would
is
that
my,
worry you?
But my perspective is that adults over-worry about what their kids are saying. That adults project their views and their anxieties onto the child. I agree with Megan. The child is stating a fact. And the parent can overreact to that or can de-escalate the situation, and it doesn't necessarily mean that child is anxious at all, that they're expressing this information. And I mean, there's lots of corollaries, I guess, to that. You know, you think my little kids, when they fell and bumped their knee, you know, I was like, oh, you'll be okay, you know, just give it a rub. And then there were parents who were like, oh, let me give you a hug and let me pick you up. You can overreact and then they'll cry more the next time. Or you can be like, chill, no big deal. You can handle this. We'll be fine. And pretty soon they don't come.
So this is the bump in your knee situation.
It is a bump in the knee situation. It is no different. Just because it's a different topic.
So what are you going to say? You're going to say to your child, look, I'm sorry that right now it looks like the world may be going that way, but you got a big opportunity, and we all do.
Well, I think the first is to find out what the kid really knows.
I just want to emphasize that. I love the simpleness of the metaphor of the bump on the knee, but you said yourself, so it's not, in fact... Mm. There is a little bit of at least a check-in.
Absolutely,
particularly if someone, if the child says something that your internal reaction as a parent is, this must have emotion tied with it, and they're showing zero emotion, you should be curious and figure out why. By no means am I suggesting you should assume they have an anxiety disorder or catastrophic thinking about it, but you should be curious and try to understand what they're thinking and feeling. And then to the extent you can, I think we talked about this, but I want to make sure we say it explicitly. Also recognize that the feelings are not the same thing as the reality or the uncertainty. So, Evan, you gave the example of talking about your feelings after this tragedy where a child died, more than one child died. And so even just voicing that, and when I feel sad, I sit with the feeling like this for a minute, and then I move on and do the next thing. So kind of making it conscious that you're acknowledging your feeling. This is how I deal with my own feelings when there's distress. And then moving on. I think that's absolutely right on. And to the extent we can make that explicit with our kids, that gives them a tool to make it explicit, to think about it. The fact that there's problems with the environment doesn't equal the emotions I'm having. I can have some control of my emotions and change it.
So, but if a child says, I'm scared about this, is part of the response, it's okay to be a little scared? I mean, there's...
Absolutely.
Absolutely.
Okay. To say, and even to say fear is normal.
Dr. G, you want to add to that?
No, I completely agree. I think Mike is right on. we have to validate the concerns that our children have, but also provide some framework for them so that they can understand, you know, when it's developmentally appropriate, they can possibly act and do something so that they feel like they have power. You know, a 7-year-old doesn't really have much power, but I loved Mike's idea. He said something about like going outside with them. And I think that's what we as parents should be doing. And we as adults in the world modeling for children, making sure that they have an appreciation for the outdoors. I think there's a lot of evidence that fostering a sense of appreciation for nature at a young age can really instill a sense of environmental stewardship as they get older. So I think Sue was talking about, I have 3 boys too, and I think we as parents, I have a responsibility to be role models. And so, you know, we can't fix the world, but we can recycle, we can compost, we can do little things within our sphere of influence. So, you know, all of us, not just in healthcare, who can interact with the world, but also serve as role models for children, can do these things and show why it's important.
Well, I mean, listeners are weighing in a number of ways here. I'm looking at the time. We got to get our only break of the hour, but I want to sort of pick up that thread of empowerment that Dr. G just brings up and talk about maybe the it can feel complex as a parent, especially on an issue like climate change, if a child is expressing concern. And I know these words mean different things, concern, fear, actual anxiety, but how to empower at different ages. So as an educator and as a parent, I mean, I'm sure Sue's got thoughts that what the difference between 7 and 12 and 17. But I also kind of want to hear from the doctors in the room about that, about how to explore the best and most healthy ways to empower without ignoring fear, but also not ratcheting it up. And I had a separate email as well from a listener named Sarah who wanted to express the opposite view. And Sarah said, let me pull this back up. I think it's the opposite from what John said. I think it would be child abuse not to talk to kids about climate change. It is their future after all. So, okay, a lot of different viewpoints, and let's hit that on the other side of this break. I'm Evan Dawson. Thursday on The Next Connections, earlier this month, adoptees 18 and older in New York State became able to access their original birth certificates. It's the first time that's been possible in 84 years. We'll talk with local adoptees about the new law and how it impacts their lives. In our second hour, we're talking about coronavirus with the experts. Talk with you on Thursday. This is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Briefly, Sue, do you agree with Sarah that if we don't teach kids about climate change, that's more of an act of abuse?
Well, I mean, I don't really want to use the word abuse.
Abuse is strong.
It's a little strong.
Especially with clinicians in the room. Yeah, we're talking very careful about
we're all mandatory reporters.
Yeah, exactly. But, you know, I come from a place where I believe you should be truthful with children, and I don't believe the truth is something to be afraid of. And I think that the truth that climate change is happening is one that the kids should be aware of. They should also know the truth that we can do something about it. But I for me, there's no difference between having those types of conversations with my children than it would be if, you know, their grandma was diagnosed with cancer.
Right.
You know, there's, you can handle the truth is an empowering thing for a kid to understand that they have the ability to be okay in this world.
Well, let me turn to the doctors and offer, sort of gingerly offer, another parallel that's starting to kind of come into my mind as I see the different approaches to teaching kids. There's been a long-running debate in this country, this big country, about productive and healthy education about sex and relationships. Scandinavia, generally speaking, tends to do it quite differently. And they start teaching at age 3 and 4 what a healthy relationship means. That doesn't mean they're teaching about sex at 3 and 4, but they're talking about boundaries and respecting people's bodies and healthy and relationships and kindness and building in a way that is cohesive all the way up to, obviously, the depth that comes with education at different levels. And I wonder if you wait to talk about which, by the way, yes, my bias is I sort of endorse more of that idea. Not teaching sex at four, but teaching healthy relationships and starting young. Trusting kids to understand that we can talk about healthy relationships, right? Mm-hmm. Same kind of thing with climate change. Like, if you're scared to talk to kids about it because it scares you or that it's concerning, and then all of a sudden they're 12 or 14 or 15 and you're dumping all of this stuff, I think they're going to be shocked. I just don't see – I feel like there has to be an approach that starts young that doesn't alarm. And I think I'm trying to draw a distinction between can you teach about something that is sort of alarming inherently but without alarming kids? Dr. Gibson, what do you think?
So this is a great topic and a great kind of question about this. I think that this kind of goes along with most of what we teach kids, because if there's one thing we've all learned through growing up, it's that becoming an adult and living on your own is terrifying in any sense. And then adding on to it the climate change concern. I think that there's plenty of opportunity to start at a young age with kind of just observing your surroundings and kids noticing things around them, as far as weather patterns and things like that, that you can kind of bring up this opportunity that, you know, just to teach them about how the world works, how outside works, and start talking a little bit about, well, things are changing, and this is how we can be responsible about this. You like going to the park, you like playing in the park. If you notice that there's litter on the ground, it's our responsibility to help clean that up and to work all together to take care of the park. And starting at a young age with that sort of thing.
And they're like sort of limited ecosystem of space there.
Exactly. Yeah. Yes. I mean, because even babies, their sight kind of changes and grows as they're growing from when they're born to eventually when we can see everything around us. The same thing psychologically happens. First, kids are very self-ego centered, where they only, you know, toddlers, if there's one thing we know about toddlers, they only know and care about themselves because that's all they can comprehend. And then their world gets bigger and bigger the more that they grow. So starting with the smaller ecosystem of the park and then working your way bigger and bigger. As far as just, I think this general theme of it's important to take care of the world and the environment around you, and then slowly working in the concerns and anxieties that come with that too. That, well, this is the reason why. And I just love the sense of empowerment. One thing that can help anxiety for anyone, whether it's normal anxiety or related to a disorder, is giving them a sense of control and sense of empowerment over that anxiety. So what Dr. Scharf mentioned about the fact that it's important to acknowledge that, yes, it's appropriate to be scared and fearful of this. Yes, that's a normal response to this. We're going to sit and feel it for a minute, and then we're going to move on. This is something we can do about it.
Dr. Scharf, you want to add to that?
I do. The whatever the scope is of what either your child, you know, maybe spontaneously is saying they're going to do, from picking up the park to being an advocate at a broader level themselves, to educating a teacher, as Sue mentioned earlier, I think we can certainly be supportive. I think we should also be looking to make sure we give them a message of when it's enough, mm-hmm. right? That the acknowledge feelings are normal, you know, bring them to awareness and talk about them with your kids, then have something to do, and then also be able to say that this is enough. You know, if your scope of influence is to be able to pick up the garbage in front of you, then pick up the garbage and then you're done and you can move on. And
what's the danger if you don't move on? When you say
you can become preoccupied. Mm-hmm. Thank you for asking that. You can become preoccupied in a way that, you know, if we think about anxiety generally, you can respond to anxiety with rituals or obsessive thoughts and behaviors related to the anxiety, and they might even be adaptive the first time you try it, but it can, you know, take on a life of its own to be its own new problem. So the idea of doing something to address whatever your environmental concerns are that you can is a good thing, but keeping it in context of your whole life. And, you know, we haven't said this explicitly when we talk about the difference between feeling anxiety and anxiety disorders. The way that organized mental health societies define the difference is when it causes functional impairment. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm, and right. I think we should say that explicitly. You know, mm-hmm, yeah. Someone having an emotional reaction to something someone presented especially if they did it to scare them, isn't especially remarkable. It's when the reaction becomes so severe that they can't get up and go to school the next day, that they avoid doing something because of the distress. That's when it's a problem.
It's an important point, and I think for some of the, to the extent there's pushback, listeners like John, and I've read in other sources before this program, the argument, Dr. G, that, well, we're robbing children's childhood. Childhood should be about wonder and excitement, and we're poisoning that with this education that they're not, there's not going to be a future of this world. How could we do that to kids? Again, I mean, I think people are jumping pretty far here instead of contextualizing, as we're hearing from your co-panelists. But can you address a little bit of that, this idea that that kids are supposed to be kids and that we shouldn't be kind of clouding their thoughts with these ideas that might provoke anxiety?
Yes. I mean, kids should be kids and they should enjoy their childhood, because certainly being an adult is not always so fun, right? but I do think a lot of things are important to discuss in the context of what we're talking about today. First of all, is this idea of acknowledging whatever distress a child has. Some people might say you have to embrace the anxiety, right? We're not denying that that is a fact, and accept that. And nobody's mentioned her name today, but the whole idea of like Greta Thunberg and all she's done as a social activist for young people, she talks pretty openly about the severe depression that she had experienced early on. And that kind of created within her an impetus to go on this journey around the world and be an example for all other young people. So I think she's an example of someone who's embraced her anxiety and depression and used that within her sphere of influence.
Well, on that subject, Alex writes to say, do you think Greta is simply projecting others or perhaps her parents' extremism, and asking, you know, isn't it true that children should also understand that not everything is always going to go their way, and untenable demands like Greta is making aren't good? This is from Alex. What do you think?
I don't know. I mean, to be totally honest, as a parent of three teenagers, I would be a little bit upset if my son decided he was going on a voyage across the world to do this. But I think it's great that she's doing it, and I appreciate what she's doing as a movement. I think that she is trying to bring an awareness to adults who are decision makers that it's so easy to fall into a state of inertia. But as I keep going back, we each have our own sphere of influence. I'm part of the Finger Lakes Children's Environmental Health Center. So it's part of what we do is educating the community, the Rochester community and 15 counties, about all these environmental health issues. So we can't tackle the world, but do what we can within our sphere of influence.
Sure, sure. And before I let Sue take a crack at Alex's thoughts on Greta, I'll ask the other doctors in the room, do you see anything that indicates a concern about mental health, or I'm not going to use the right clinical word, anything that concerns you with Greta's story?
Well, it's a long held and valued position in psychiatry not to analyze people in the media that we haven't directly examined. So I'm not going to try to do that. I think the point in Alex's message that I would respond to is, you know, is there a risk when a child, you know, presents as an advocate that it was someone else egged them on, or it wasn't really their idea? Sure, there's a risk, but as a parent, if this is your child, the process is really what we've been talking about. You know, don't assume anything. Mm-hmm. Really hear them out. You know, if Sandy, as you said, the idea, if it was my kid wanting to take a boat ride across the ocean, that I'm having a little anxiety thinking about that right now. But if it was really genuinely their thing that they came up with, and it was in the context of them going to school and having fun and, you know, doing the other activities they like, I'd hear them out. I'd entertain it. Mm. But the distinction is hearing them out and supporting what they're coming up with in the context of their whole life, as opposed to what was suggested, which is sort of egging them on or telling them to do it.
Sure, sure. Dr. Gibson, how do you feel about what you've seen with Greta?
So I'm actually just going to ditto everything that Dr. Sharp said.
That's fair. Yeah. Fair enough. Sue, you want to respond to Alex's concern that Greta is somehow sort of only projecting the anxiety of others who've projected that onto her?
Well, I guess a couple things. For one, if you're a parent, like, everybody always second guesses you.
Mm-hmm.
Right. And so, okay. So here's another person criticizing someone else who has no information about the relationship between this child or this parent or how things have developed. Okay.
You might have read half an article somewhere.
Maybe. You know, I don't know. And I certainly don't know their relationship. I know that Greta says she has autism.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
I know that her family has a scientific background. But it's not really my place to decide what is appropriate for Greta. And then my other issue is that really Greta has been kind of foisted into the public attention, not through any means of her own. She was protesting in front of her local government building, and the media glommed on to her because she is a powerful speaker. She speaks with passion, and they've made something out of her. And so consequently, she gets invitations to go and speak to the UN and so forth. And if she's comfortable traveling and her parents are comfortable with her traveling to do those things, more power to them. I think what an amazing experience. Mm-hmm. And really, like, our whole conception of childhood on some level feels like it's a made-up thing that only privileged societies of recent times really ever had. I mean, my mom grew up on a farm. She was working from the time she was six. Right. And she lived away at home at 13. That's not that long ago. And so I just have a lot of questions around that. When people start, oh, well, what should childhood be? And who's not to say she's not having the best childhood anyone ever has had? Yeah.
Fair. And for her, it may be the only childhood she can imagine, given everything she understands and knows.
Right.
Mm-hmm. When we talk about what kids are learning, a lot of it obviously comes from school. Schools are every year doing sort of increasingly more at younger ages on climate, appropriately so and understandably so.
I hope so.
I think that's been studied, and maybe it's not enough for the educator in the room like you. What do you do as a parent, and then I want to turn to the doctors on this, to make sure that you feel what's being taught? I mean, is there a role in understanding what is being taught in schools about it being appropriate when it comes to an issue like climate?
On the issue of climate, my personal experience from my kids is that not nearly enough is happening. So I worry less.
Even now.
Even now. Hmm. I worry much less that they are getting misleading information than that they're just not getting really much information at all. So I'd have different opinions on different subjects, but when you're talking about climate.
All right. So, and it sounds like that you've worked to, mm-hmm. well, I made an assumption there. I don't want to make an assumption. Mm-hmm. I was assuming that you've worked to fill in the gaps that you see, you know, maybe not happening on the school level, but it sounds like you've also let your kids sort of ask questions on their own when they see you going off to do some work, et cetera.
Right. I have not forced climate or climate advocacy on my kids. And in fact, when an opportunity developed in 2015 to create the Rochester Youth Climate Leaders, two of my sons were invited to be on that leadership team. I specifically did not involve myself. I was not the parent support person. I was not the liaison because I needed them to know that this, they could do it or not do it. It didn't have anything to do with me. So that was very intentional on my part, and I've tried to support them, and I'm sure they feel it's very much a communal thing at our house because so much of what we do as a family is around this issue, but I really try to let them lead and decide.
Fair enough. Well, Dr. G, Mike writes to us on Twitter and says, if my son comes home from school and is upset or has anxiety from being told or indoctrinated about climate change, I would be on the phone the next day with the administration telling them to stop this nonsense. Sounds like Mike has certainly individual views on climate, but is also not interested in anything that's going to cause undue anxiety. When is it right for a parent to step in and make a phone call and say, I need to know what you're teaching because I'm worried about the psychological impact or the mental health impact?
Well, I think if a parent has a concern, they are, you know, allowed to raise it. I think I really don't know enough about whether or not it would be appropriate to what they're learning in school. But I do think it is important to talk about climate change. I believe it's a real thing, and I don't personally believe that we should continue to deny that science. But you know, it's like religion in school. Some people have very strong feelings about that. I can see there might be some controversy. I can't really imagine. I guess it would depend on that specific situation.
Yeah, what they're telling you about. Dr. Scharf, how do you sort of figure out what to do there?
Well, I totally get the gist of the message. Yeah. And I hope that if I was in Mike's shoes, and I would be tempted to call too, but my first comment wouldn't be stop. It would be to ask, how did this come up? What class was this? Why did this come up? And really try to understand it. And if there's like a curriculum-based way that it makes sense, I'd take less issue with it. And if it was, one individual's, moment on a podium to scare the kids, then I would tell them to stop. So it really depends on the details. I think that one thing I want to make sure we get out there is you talk about what we teach kids. I think we also need to be teaching about things that we've done that have been successful, right? And the Clean Air Act, the impact of the Clean Air Act on particulate matter in the air and, even just what the air looks like over New York and London.
I'm from Cleveland, where the river caught fire in the 1970s.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And so I think that, talking about the fact that, we do things and it does make a difference, I think is equally important. Mm-hmm. To the extent that we can foster a sense of optimism about people's ability to overcome challenges, even when we don't really know how yet, I think that has a value too in teaching kids, not just the idea that climate change is happening and the negative outcome is a foregone conclusion, but, there's these things we see, we believe this is what's going to happen if we don't interrupt it, but we're mankind, we can interrupt it, we can do something. We went to the moon,
Empowerment there.
Yeah.
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 Anything you want to add there, Dr. Gibson, on the value of empowerment?
I think, again, it's just something that will really help to build resiliency through something that is inherently anxiety provoking for anyone, whether appropriate or whether just a normal reaction versus to the disorder level. I think it's been mentioned a few times, but the importance of just curiosity into what kids know, what kids are being taught, curiosity to the schools, to how it's taught. That's how I approach anytime a patient comes to me with anxiety, is just gentle curiosity about what it is that's anxiety provoking for them, because I can project my own anxieties onto, I imagine I would feel this way.
Sure.
But that's totally different from what the kid themselves is feeling.
And just getting away from climate, just a general question, especially for parents thinking about their kids. I think what you just described was discerning between sort of an incidence of anxiety on a particular day versus a disorder level.
Mm-hmm.
How do you start to ask the right questions to make sure, I want to make sure I understand my child. I might want to get some professional opinion on. Is there something beyond just this was a hard day or this affected you a certain way versus this is a disorder?
Yeah, so I think starting with, this sounds like something that's really on your mind and really weighing on you. How often do you think about this? Starting there and then being a little more curious of when you think about this, does it get in the way of other things? Are you thinking about it at school? Is it interfering with your ability to pay attention in school? How's your sleep at night? Are you eating? Things like that. And then if you notice that there are some areas in their life that's impacted in a way it didn't used to be, then maybe seeking out a professional evaluation.
What's a good place to start with a professional evaluation?
So talking to your pediatrician first can always
start
be helpful,
okay.
Just because they're aware of the local resources and kind of what supports are available. Unfortunately, child psychiatry is still a growing subspecialty, and there definitely is more demand than there is supply currently. But every kid should have a pediatrician that they can at least start with so they can get linked with those resources.
And
I'll expand on that. The children's mental health issues are the most significant chronic illnesses of childhood right now, and it is a shortage specialty, but we're doing things to address it right here in Rochester.
Mm-hmm.
In 5 months, we're going to open a new facility, a pediatric behavioral health and wellness building that's going to allow us to expand our outpatient services by 20% and our partial hospital services by 50%. Big deal. Hopefully I'll have the opportunity to talk about that more. But as a starting point, again, you don't have to go right to the psychiatrist or to the mental health center. Starting with people that you trust in your day-to-day life, and again, the guiding principle being what Annalyn said of, you know your kid, what's normal, and if there's things you don't know, ask, meet them where they're at. As soon as it starts to interfere with function, that's when you want to get more formal involvement. Primary care, whether it's a family medicine doc, a nurse practitioner, a pediatrician, can be a great place to start. And in New York, we have a service that supports primary care where they can speak to a child psychiatrist in real time from 8 a.m. to 7 p.m. every weekday to get added support, even if you bring up an issue about anxiety or something else that they're not an expert in. And I would like...
Yes, and we have used that service, Mike. Yeah, so we at the Golisano Children's Hospital at Strong, we have the benefit of an integrated pediatric practice. So we work hand in hand with behavioral health who work together with us in the same clinical space. So we are very fortunate because when we have issues around anxiety, depression, or anything, we have our colleagues to rely on. And when we get a little bit of, you know, underwater and need some help, then I can be on the phone and talk to Mike or another child psychiatrist for some of the more complex medication management questions that we have.
Mm-hmm. And when's the new program, the new facility open?
We're targeting a June date. I don't have an exact ribbon-cutting date yet, but it will be in June.
All right, come back that week.
Sounds good.
We would love to do that, especially, as you say, one of the largest, if not the largest, sort of ongoing health issues facing kids. So absolutely, we'd love that.
Great.
Sue, just for the moment, the last 30 seconds, we're going to pretend the doctors aren't in the room, and I'll just ask you this as a parent. Do you think it's important to make sure that we trust kids that as long as we try to talk to them appropriately, they can handle stuff like climate change more than maybe we thought they could?
Oh, I think so. Absolutely. I think kids need to know that, not by telling them so much, but by demonstrating to them that you are confident in their abilities by being honest with them, by trusting them with information if they're seeking it.
Thank you for the work that you do, as always. I appreciate that.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Sue Hugh Smith is a co-founder of RPCC, the Rochester People's Climate Coalition. And our thanks to Dr. Annalyn Gibson, Dr. Sandra G., Dr. Michael Scharf. Thanks for taking the time to be here and lend your expertise. Greatly appreciated that. Thanks to all of you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks to the entire team today. Don helping us out as a volunteer. Emery Stein is the intern with Connections. Rob Braden is the engineer. And Megan Mack is the producer. I'm Evan Dawson. Have a nice afternoon. Talk to you tomorrow on member-supported public radio.